So what we're looking at, so section 7 has to do with the way that God relates to the world, and particularly his people. And as we look at the Bible, the way that God relates to his creation, to mankind, but specifically the way that it is revealed to us that he relates to his people is in the framework of covenant. Section 7:1 says, though rational creatures, meaning those who are capable of rational thought, so that would be human beings and angels, are responsible to obey God as their creator, the distance between God and these creatures is so great that they could never have attained the reward of life except by God's voluntary condescension. He has been pleased to express this through a covenant framework. So when the confession talks about the distance between God and creatures being so great that we could have never attained the reward of life, what is that talking about? Why is that gulf so great? Sin? That's a major one, but why else? Because God is God, and we are not. Because the interesting thing that this is talking about, 7.1 is talking about, is not in dealing with sin. It's dealing with the fact that we are creatures, and God is the creator. And that though he created us, there is no way that we could know him. There's no way that we could receive the rewards and a relationship with him. No way that we could glory in him and know him except through the fact that he would have to condescend to us. You know, we see in the Bible Adam and Eve being placed in the garden, and we're told that Adam and God would walk together in the garden in the cool of the day. You know, God had to condescend to communicate with Adam. He could have simply left Adam to his own devices. But there has to be that condescension where he says, even though I am the creator of the universe, I know all things. There is nothing that is hidden from me. I am all powerful. But yet you, this finite creature in this garden in Mesopotamia, I am going to come down and I'm going to talk to you. I'm going to have a relationship with you. He has to condescend even to the perfect sinless Adam. And the way that he does this, or the framework under which he does this, is through covenant. Now, Pastor Corey talked a little bit about what a covenant is. What is a covenant? An agreement? Is any agreement a covenant? So usually it's an agreement between two parties that usually has is legally binding. The one we're talking about, we need to be careful when we talk about that, because while that is true in the realm of human covenants, when we talk about the covenants that God makes with man, it is not a covenant. It is not an agreement where we sit in and negotiate, is it? You know, it's not a matter of God says, Moses, I have 12 commandments for you. And Moses says, whoa, that's a lot of commandments. Maybe 8. And then they can kind of meet in the middle at 10. So that's not the kind of agreement that God makes with his people. A covenant that God makes with his people. One of the best definitions that I found of it. This is a good pitch for you guys to pick up. I just checked. There's two copies on the book table of Christ and the Covenants by O. Palmer Robertson. It's one of the best overall treatments about how God deals with his people in covenant. And the definition that he gives is a bond in blood, sovereignly administered. A bond in blood, sovereignly administered. And so when we talk about a bond in blood, what that means is that with this agreement, there are usually blessings and penalties associated with it. If you keep this agreement, there will be blessings. If you do not, there are penalties associated with it. I don't know if you remember in Genesis chapter 15, when God makes his covenant with Abram, and Abram sees as the sun goes down. So Abram had to sacrifice rams, and he would have to, and he laid them out. He cut them in half and laid them apart. And then Abram saw the torch and the smoking pot pass through between the divided rams. And that was a way of expressing that if I were to violate this covenant, may this happen to me. It was actually a form of covenant making that would have been known in the Middle East at that time. And so, of course, God does not violate that covenant because he is faithful. But what we're talking about here in 7.1, we're talking about God. So this is, we're talking pre-fall here. That God, through his creation with the sinless Adam and Eve, has said that in order for them to know him, in order for them to have relationship with him, he is going to express his desire for them and give them opportunity to know him and receive reward from him through the framework of covenant. And so the thing that we usually term this covenant and I know that Pastor Corey talked briefly about this. This is often called the covenant of works. So, in the framework of the garden, Adam is told to do what? What are the things that Adam is commanded to do? Keep the garden. Exercise dominion, be fruitful and multiply. What's the biggie though? Don't eat of the tree. Now, this is sheer speculation on my part. It could be the fact that Adam was told other things as well, but we don't know because he didn't violate those ones. So that's not key to the narrative. In the garden, was not eating the tree the only law that Adam had to keep? No. He had to tend the garden. He had to, if he had said, you know what, I like being a couple with no kids. We're just not going to multiply. That would have been disobedience. If he had decided to lie to his wife, that would have been disobedience. Of course, if he had decided to murder his wife, that would have been disobedience as well. So we see that even in the garden, that the law that we later see summed up in the Ten Commandments, still applied. But there was a very specific law that was given to Adam, which was that he should not eat of this particular tree. And the promise given to him, so what was told to him is if the day you eat of it, you will die. And so the implied opposite is if you obey, then what? You will live. And we're also told that in Genesis 3, when Adam is cast out of the garden, God says that we have to keep him from the garden because otherwise he could eat of the tree of life. And so it is implied that that would have been his reward if he had, through that probationary period, had remained faithful. And so some people would object and say the word covenant. You can't say this is covenant because the word covenant is never used. Right? And that is true. Though it is interesting that if you look at the founding, the creation of the Davidic covenant, the word covenant is never used there either. But a couple days ago, I got an email from my brother-in-law saying, hey, this Sunday is Nicole's birthday. Let's get together to celebrate her birthday. We'll sing to her. We'll have presents. We'll have a cake. And she, you know, we can all sing happy birthday to her. What do we call that? What kind of event is that? It's a birthday party. Did he ever say birthday party? Did he ever say come for Nicole's birthday party? No, but you know, there's presents. It's her birthday. There's a cake. There's candles. There's presents. There's singing of the happy birthday song. All the marks of a birthday party are there, whether he called it a birthday party or not. It passes the birthday party test. And so if we talk about what is a covenant is a bond in blood. By a bond in blood, we mean that it is an agreement with life or death consequences. That is sovereignly administered, and we'll get to what that means, you know, where it is administered by God, with attendant blessings, with blessings and curses. Does God's institution, does God's creation commands to Adam fit that framework of covenant? I think that it does. And so whether you call it the oftentimes it's called the covenant of works. It is interesting, if you look at the 1689 confession and compare it to the Westminster Confession of Faith, that this is one of the chapters where there is a lot of differences. We primarily expect the differences between the Westminster and the 1689 to be over the have to admit, I'm not entirely sure what their reasoning is. In the Westminster, there is this paragraph 7.1, which is basically verbatim, repeated in 1689. But then a paragraph that the 1689 deletes entirely specifically talks about the covenant of works. And so some people might look at that and be like, oh, well, they didn't believe in this covenant of works. And I don't, that's not the case at all. Could someone turn to So what it says right. Like Adam, they transgressed the covenant. There they dealt faithlessly with me. So Hosea is expressing that as Adam was faithless to his covenant with God, So Israel is being faithless to their covenant with God. So while Genesis, 1, 2, and 3 does not use the word covenant in the way in talking about that creation, Garden of Eden administration, the book of Hosea does. But when we, the thing that I do want to mention though, and what this, the focus of this is oftentimes when we're talking about the covenant of works, we talk. And I want to emphasize that that is not the case. The first and most obvious way that grace was present was simply the fact that God chose to create as opposed to not. Right? He was under no obligation to create human beings. That is grace. If you look at the proof text for this section, could someone read the first one, Luke chapter 17, verse 10? And could someone else read Job chapter 35, 7 through 8? Obeying him, we're simply doing what we ought to do. And so what we see in this, what we call the covenant of works, and I think that, that's why maybe this word works is maybe a little bit misleading. What was the one that Mike Horton uses, Daniel? Covenant of creation? Yeah, so it's also been called, you could call it the covenant, you could call it the Adamic covenant, the covenant made with Adam. You could call it the covenant of creation. But even that is a gracious covenant. It says, if you do this thing, you will have eternal life. You will be mine. I will know you. I will love you. And that is not something that is that we have earned. That is God's gracious way. Add to God's glory. We do not add to his happiness or contentment by obeying him. The benefit is entirely for us. So the obligations to which we agree are imposed entirely by Him. The benefits are entirely for us, and He is bound to keep it by nothing but His Word. Robertson says that God would have surely have given him a great reward, but not because Adam demanded it. He would have given it only because it is His good pleasure to confer upon the creature gifts which no one can ever earn, even by sinless obedience, which is, after all, but the debt we already owe. Would have owed it to Adam because God Himself promised it. And that promise itself was a gracious promise. It is not a matter of simply justice to give Adam love and relationship. So when we talk about we're going to talk about the two great covenants that we talk about that God has administered or has dealt with man under. The covenant of works, that's the covenant that Adam was under, and of course he represented us in this. And so Adam's covenant violation, we are all under the punishments that resulted from Adam's violation of this covenant, of him as a covenant breaker. We are covenant breakers in Adam. The other great covenant, which is what we're going to talk about in sections 2 and 3, is the covenant of grace. And so, but one thing that we need to be straight on as we're talking through this covenant of obedience. The covenant of works is a covenant of obedience where our acceptance to God was rooted in our obedience to these conditions. If you do these things, if you obey my law, not just not eat of the tree, but if you perfectly continue to be upright and righteous and obey my law, then you will be rewarded. Well, Christians who talk as if the law only condemns and has no place in the ongoing life of the Christian. And when we say yes, we broke the covenant, we have fallen short of that. That does not mean that God's law has no place in our heart. When we say we are not under law, what we're saying is we are not under law as our covenant. We are not under this covenant of works. We do not rely on law as our, and in obedience to the law as our basis for pleasing God and fulfilling His obligations. But it does not mean that law has no place in our life. The Reformed have typically talked about this under the rubric of what? Does anyone know what I'm talking about? The three uses of the law. Does anyone know what the first use of the law is? This is a scheme that was originally. When I say scheme, I don't mean that it was an invention. This was a summary of what the Bible teaches, but it was first put, I think, under these headings by John Calvin. Does anyone know the first use of the law? There's.
I don't know if it's the first use, but it might be in the list. But it's to show us the sinfulness of sin.
Yes. So the first use of the law is has a mirror. Its purpose is to show us the character of God, His holiness, what He demands of us, to show us that we fall short of that standard, and to cause us to have to realize that we have no hope in ourselves of fulfilling this righteous standard, that He is holy, we are not, and therefore that we are in need of forgiveness. And so that is the first use of the law. Anyone else? Daniel? What? The civil use, which is, or the to restrain evil. Why is it that we have laws against theft and murder? Well, not just because God, people who don't even believe in God, like, still have laws against these things. What are they trying to accomplish with those? They're trying to create a peace. Exactly. It's like, if we can just leave each other alone enough that we can kind of coexist. So there is an element to which the fear of punishment restrains people from doing things that they might otherwise do. Now, does this change anyone's hearts? No. Sometimes people, like when we talk about, you might hear the expression, you can't legislate morality. And I would say, what else is criminal law but legislated morality? Now, what people oftentimes mean by that is you can't cause someone to believe something is wrong simply by making a law against it. And the fact is, that is true, but that assumes that the person that we're trying to help here is the person who's violating it. But who are we actually trying to help by the second use? The victim. I want abortion to be illegal. And if someone says, well, that's not going to change anyone's heart, I'm like, I don't care. The baby's not going to be dead. That's the purpose of this. And so so whether it's law exercised civilly by our government, or even law by which someone might fear to do something evil, might fear to commit adultery, might fear to commit some sin because they are afraid that to do so would bring upon them the wrath of God. And so the second use is one that is sheerly negative, which is that it restrains evil. People see the law, they're afraid of the consequences, they don't act out those things that are within their hearts. And the third use of the law, which is the one that we as Christians should be most concerned about, because it applies sheerly to us. It is as a guide to life and conduct. If we are no longer under the penalty of the law, if we are no longer if the covenant of works no longer applies to us, if our standing before God no longer rises or falls based on our ability to keep His law, why do we care about this? Why would we care about keeping God's law? When we say it's a guide to life and conduct, it is a picture of what the character of God is like. These two uses are very related, or related to each other. Both of them say, this is what God is like. And the first one says, and therefore you're not like him. The second one says, and this is how you do the things that he loves. When we have been set free from the necessity of obeying the law for our acceptance before God, which of course we can only fail at, then we are free to look at that law under a completely different, we're free to now relate to it in an entirely different way. We can look upon God's law not terror because we have fallen short of it, and because we're under the threat of punishment, but we can relate to God's law and obey it because it shows us the things that we can do that God loves. Empowered by His Spirit, not on our own, but the things that we can do to be that show that we are being more and more made into the image of Christ. If you love someone, you want to do the things that please them. You know, if I bring my wife flowers, you know, it's not because because I'm afraid that if I don't, she'll be angry at me. I hope. It's because it's something that she loves. I think John Piper told some story about a husband who asked his wife early on their marriage. He said, "Must I kiss you goodnight every night?" And she says, "Yes, you must, but not that kind of must." And that's the same way. So this is a way that we can show not our obligation, but our delight in who God is and our thankfulness and our gratitude. And it should overflow in wanting to do the things that he loves and hating the things that he hates. And so next week we're going to be looking at the covenant of grace and what that means, that we are no longer under the covenant of works, but under the covenant of grace. But that does not, I want to emphasize that does not mean that there is that obedience, that law has no place in our lives, but the role that it does have has been radically changed. It is not something that brings fear.
Wanted to end with a quote by O. Palmer Robertson. It says, "By creation, God bound himself to man in covenantal relationship. After man's fall into sin, the God of all creation graciously bound himself to man again by committing himself to redeem a people to himself from lost humanity. From creation to consummation, the covenantal bond has determined the relation of God to his people. The extent of the divine covenants reaches from the beginning of the world to the end of the age." So as we look at this and we see, you know, what is going on with the covenant of works, that it was a gracious covenant, what do we do with this? Why does this matter to us? What does this tell us about God? What does this change about our conduct? What does this mean to our lives? Does it mean anything?
It means that God's really, really concerned about every person and how they obey him. He's not just didn't create a bunch of millions of people and they're all off doing their own thing. He's really concerned about every person and how they relate to him.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? response. I think the thing that I found most interesting about this is when I first read this paragraph, and it talked about God having to, about the gulf between, the distance between God and His creatures being so great that He has to condescend to Bridget. I too was thinking, oh, that's talking about sin. It's dealing about the fact that we're sinful creatures. And as I dug in more, the realization that no, even as perfect, upright, unfallen human beings, God still needed to graciously condescend to us. That just because He created us does not mean what we could have even earned if Adam had perfectly obeyed. That even the creation covenant was a gracious, loving covenant in which God, the great and infinite God, reached down to finite people in love and grace. And that is something that I think that in some ways, if we think that the reward that Adam was promised was something that was earned, diminishes the graciousness of God, even in creation. And so I think it gives us a higher view of God's grace when we see that even in the garden, that was a gracious, loving, and merciful administration. Yeah, exactly. And we'll talk about more of that, about that in the covenant of grace. But yet, it's not as if this no longer applies. I read something this week about, like, you think about what were the circumstances of the temptation of Adam? He was in a perfect, beautiful, blissful garden. He was surrounded by people that he loves. He was well fed. He was comfortable. And he failed. What were the circumstances around Christ's temptation? He was alone. He was in the desert. He was starving. And yet, in the midst, Adam fell under the perfect conditions, and Christ was faithful even under the more adverse conditions than you and I will ever face. Should remind us that we have a great covenant-keeping Savior who is a much greater second Adam. Also, as we think about the place that obedience has in our lives, and we see the place that law has in the life of the believer, I hope that should make you want to know the law, study the law, understand it so that you can, we want to do it not so that we're afraid that, like, oh, if I don't obey it right, God's gonna whack me. It's because, if you want to love your spouse, you want to, what are the things she likes? You talk to her friends, like, oh, what's her favorite food? When you're first dating and you're trying to, like, find out some place that she'd like, you might go to her friends and say, what are some restaurants that she likes? What kind of desserts does she like? What are some gifts that she, what does she need? You want to know these things because you want to do things that please her. In the same way, we should want to know the law. We should want to know His word, not because we're afraid that He's going to come, fall on us in wrath, but because we want to live in a way that delights Him. And we want to live our lives in a way that that more and more reflects the image of our Savior. Anything else? Yo.
Please keep that in mind as you hear the sermon today.
There are certainly those, there are those who are even, there are even those within the Reformed tradition who have downplayed this. And if you're familiar with current events in evangelicalism, you might, you know, the one prominent teacher who was very anti-third use of the law lost his ministry because he was caught in an adulterous relationship. I don't want to say that's a one-to-one relationship, but I don't think that could have helped.